had an interview with Putin. Tucker Carlson went to Moscow to do this interview. How did you find this interview? How important was that?
You know, an interview, especially one that lasts as long as that one did, which was much longer than these kinds of interviews usually are. But an interview like that is usually an opportunity to do two things. Number one, to get a condensed summary of the official position on a range of subjects. So in this case, we knew in advance the key subject would be the war in Ukraine and what it means and why it's that happening and so forth. So you would get a condensed statement from the leader of one side, well, how they understand the purposes and the problems of the war. I would look for that interview in the same way that I would look for an interview of Mr. Zelensky on the Ukrainian side, or possibly Mr. Biden on the United States side. The second thing one looks for in an interview like that is whether there is something new. And there's something new information, a new kind of emphasis, a new point indicating an openness to ending a war, because a war is something that assumedly we all want to end as soon as possible. So I looked at the interview with Mr. Putin to see if there were any new items, anything different, any emphasis that had changed that would be a reasonable basis to speculate, to hope for something, and to talk about that. So, and I do that with all these kinds of things. I'm never disappointed that it's that part of it is just the official line being presented, because that's what it's for. A press conference with Mr. Zelensky would be full of that, and they have been. And press conferences with Mr. Biden are full of that, and they have been. And you likewise look for something new, which is sometimes there, or a change of emphasis. So I found Mr. Putin's interview with Tucker Carlson perfectly in line with that. There were a few, I wouldn't call them new things. It was mostly a statement of a position. I found it very interesting that he spent that first half hour on the ancient history of Russia and Ukraine, not so much because there was new information. I'm a professor of economic history. I'm familiar with that. But it was interesting that it was so present in his mind, that he was so concerned to talk about that history, to make his audience aware of that history. Other than that, I thought he did a perfectly reasonable job. I didn't think it was terribly brilliant, but I didn't think it was a disaster either. He got across the Russian view of all of this, and I thought that he did that perfectly reasonably. You could have asked him some more questions. On the other hand, it was a long interview. It is not Tucker Carlson's fault, nor Putin's, that there are so few. I am frankly ashamed of the mass media in the United States. I don't expect much from our government anymore. It has reached a level of disconnectedness where it's more pathological than it is interesting as a topic. There's not much there. The symbolism of having the same old men who were the oldest who ever ran 4 years ago to be once again the oldest to ever run, I mean, it's pathetic. It is a kind of a wow. These two countries can't do better. This country can't do better than these two candidates. Wow. What a statement. Anyway, I found it disgusting to see the media line up and attack Tucker Carlson. He's a journalist. He's not responsible for what the people he interviews have to say. He really isn't. He asked a lot of questions, and he went about as far as you can to be aggressively impolite. I know some Americans think that's great journalism. It usually isn't. What it does is it irritates the person you're asking questions to, and then you don't get a thought-through answer. You get a kind of pushback, and why this is attractive, I don't know. I never understood it. The real flaw here is, let me put it this way. A great thinker, and I don't remember who it is, but a great thinker once said that the first casualty in every war is the truth. That what wars do is make people lie terribly. Each side tells unspeakable stories about how awful the other side is and how wonderful they are. War crimes are always committed by the other side, and you are noble and you care for people. And nobody in their right mind believes this anymore. So the only strange thing is why people talk like that. It's very strange. You know, we should have had Mr. Putin interviewed all the time. He should be interviewed, you know, by this person and that person. One question here, another question there. What's the fear? By not allowing him to have a chance to speak to the American people, what you're doing is suggesting to the American people that we have something to hide, which we probably do, because it's been suggested to me. Let him speak. You know, let him speak. You can make a criticism afterward. You can question him. You can do all of that. But the idea that he shouldn't be allowed to speak, this is a very crude and unfortunately very bad American habit. We call it here the demonization of your opponent. It comes out of very bad religious wars in the Europe, which led to the colonization of the United States in many ways, so that the people came were parts of sects that were being persecuted for their religious beliefs. And so it was a matter that God preferred you to them, or say all these dramatic exaggerations of what we were all namely doing was being human beings trying to find a way to live, a way to build our societies, and so on. Very, very bad habit. And you see it here inside the United States these days, where people call each other every name in the book, and there's a constant desire to demonize. Trump is a criminal. Biden is a criminal. They are stealing. They are murdering. This endless, overdrawn drama, wow, it doesn't help solve any problem. It makes communication more difficult, and it makes these interviews more rare. So again, my feeling is, I'm glad Tucker Carlson broke that pattern, had the courage to try. According to Carlson in other interviews, he was working for at least 3 years trying to set this appointment up, and that the Russians didn't agree because of activities by the United States, which didn't want Carlson to do it. I mean, this is what he says, and nobody has refuted him, so I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt.
In this interview, when Tucker Carlson asked him about the relationship between Russia and China, Putin comes to two key points. He says that China's foreign policy is not aggressive. It's all about compromise and cooperation. Why we are having such difficulties when it comes to these superpowers? They can communicate to each other.
Okay, I should explain that I watched the interviews with as much interest in learning about Tucker Carlson as I did in learning about Russia, Ukraine, and Vladimir Putin. And I came away feeling I had learned very much about Tucker Carlson that I had not understood before, which I am grateful for, because I think Tucker Carlson is an important person in American history in the way that he is now changing. And I think it's worth our discussing that, because it is, for your audience, important to see the broader changes that are signaled by what is coming out of the mouth and the life of Tucker Carlson. But to answer your question first, I think what Russia means is that they have discovered that despite profound tensions, conflicts, and disagreements between them and the Chinese, they have been able, even before the war in Ukraine, well before the war in Ukraine, to work out an arrangement of cooperation, compromise, and so on. Just to remind an audience that may have forgotten, it's not that many years ago that China and Russia were at war with one another. They had military conflicts over borders, they had profound disagreements on the policy to take in relationship to the war in Vietnam, and a whole host of other issues that brought them to physical blows. Okay, all of that had to be rethought. You had to work out some compromises. They have some disagreements. There's still some leftover issues in the Pacific Ocean, in the boundary areas up there between Japan, China, and Russia in the north, and so on. So there's a lot of compromise and adjustment that had to be worked out over recent decades between those two countries. It is not a simple coming together in the face of the United States or anything like that. They were in greater danger from the United States back when they went to war against each other than they are now. And yet they had that war. They took those risks. So it means a lot when Putin says he's talking about what they had to do to work all of that out. Number one. Number two, Putin clearly proceeds with a deep historical awareness. And I have to tell you, in all honesty, that American politicians don't do that. It's not that they don't do history, but they do a fantastic history, a make-believe, a history of an imaginary. I mean, you can literally see it now. Former President Trump calls his movement Make America Great Again. So he has in his mind an idea of America Great Again. Although most of the things he points to weren't great 40 years ago, and they were even less great 80 years ago. What is he talking about? He's not really talking about what conditions were. Imagine telling, for example, a female in America, or a Black person in America, or a Hispanic, Latino immigrant, he wants to make America like it used to be. It used to be a country of horrendous Jim Crow racism. Women have only had the vote for barely a century in this. I mean, how far back do you want to go? And the further back you go, the worse the conditions for non-whites and women. Right away, that's a majority of our people. Okay, I mean, what are you talking about? It's not a real history. It's a fantasy history. Very, very different. You have the feeling that Mr. Putin, looking at him and listening again to that remarkable historical lecture, that he is more aware than Americans are, that there have been multiple efforts to force Russia to subordinate itself to military attacks coming from the West. Let's review, okay? Let's really do this carefully. There's the invasion of Russia at the beginning of the 19th century by Napoleon. Attack Russia, invade Russia, determined to take Russia over, failure. Then there's the Soviet Revolution in 1917. Immediately following the revolution, an attack from the West, mostly the United States, France, and Britain, with a partnership of Japan, invade the new Soviet Union, trying to change its regime. The war there, the civil war with the foreigners involved, lasts 3 or 4 years, roughly 1917 to 1921, and it is a failure. Okay? Between those two, you had World War I, which is again an attack on Russia, this time from Germany, and you have it again in World War II with Hitler. Every single one of these four distinct attacks failed. Russia defeated everyone. So the record, the modern historical record of fighting a war in Europe against Russia is West 0, Russia 4. Now, that doesn't prove anything about the future. It doesn't mean we know what will happen next time. But it ought to make you be very, very careful about attacking the Russians or the Soviet Union. These are people who have demonstrated not a good idea. Very likely you are going to be defeated. And to make sure that no one misunderstands me, I follow as closely as I know how the war in Ukraine. I have now become aware over the last 3 or 4 weeks of how that war concentrated in the city of Avdeva. Yeah, sorry about that. But it's clear to me from Bakhmut for before to this city now, Ukraine is losing the war and Russia is winning the war, and that should surprise no one. The United States cannot use the nuclear weapons that it has because that's crazy, given what the issues are. And short of nuclear weapons, you're not going to defeat Russia. Nobody ever has. This is not rocket science, folks. This is very strange politics that go in here. Okay. So I think Mr. Putin knows all of this and understands the array of forces. He doesn't make the kinds of slips that Mr. Biden does in speaking, and he doesn't make the kind of slips Mr. Trump does in speaking. No one can miss that. You can pretend not to notice, but that's what it requires, pretense. Otherwise, you can see what's going on. So I am trying to look at it from an American perspective, seeing him as the leader of an important country in this world against which we have conflict. All right, now a word, if I can, about the conflict. There is something deeply suspicious here that ought to be asked, but by American media never is. And it was alluded to by Mr. Putin during the interview. And Tucker Carlson could have done more with it, although he did take it further than most American reporters are willing to. So I want to be fair to Mr. Carlson. Okay, here's the reality. For the entirety of the Cold War, roughly from the late 1940s, until the collapse of the Soviet Union, the enmity between the United States and the Soviet Union was presented to us by every single American leader as a fight between capitalism, freedom, and democracy on the one hand, and socialism, communism, and dictatorship on the other. It was a noble struggle of one set of political and ideological commitments against another. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989, and when they went through their change, what emerged was a new government completely opposed to the Soviet Union. It dismantled its socialism. It converted state property to private property in large part, not 100%, but it's not 100% anywhere in the world, including the United States. It denounced socialism, and it made the Communist Party a minor political organization, as it is in many countries. Mr. Putin emerged as the leader of the anti-Soviet new Russian Federation. In the course of that, he proposed, as did all the European countries, a completely new relationship with the West, now that the ideological political conflict was no longer there. There was no longer the democracy versus socialism, communism. Now, one of two things happened. Either they could not work this out, or, as Mr. Putin presented it, he asked to become part of NATO to overcome the division, and the West refused. I don't know the details, and for what I'm about to say, it doesn't matter. But to discover today that we are told, as we are, that Mr. Putin is the same thing as Stalin was, and that equation is made all the time by all kinds of commentators, political leaders, and others. Putin and his thugs. You know, we are presented with an image very like what I grew up here in the United States, hearing about Stalin, but then later Khrushchev, and later, you know, fill in the blank, all of them. That is very suspicious. This looks like we have to have an enemy, and if it isn't one kind, we'll make the next one an enemy too. I mean, Russia and the Soviet Union are radically different in a thousand ways that I can explain to you and that anyone who studies them sees. Why would we have the same hostility and enmity, using the same language to describe the same leader who is so opposed? This is extraordinary. And one ought to wonder how much of this is a problem between the United States and Soviet Union on one hand, the United States and Russia on the other. There could be some problems, of course, between them. But how much of it is the United States being a society that always needs a terribly dangerous foreign enemy? Maybe that's the behavior of a country that can't hold itself together any other way. Maybe that's the behavior of a country made up of one wave of immigrants after another, who's suspicious of each other, who worry about each other, who don't trust each other, who need an external enemy. And if one goes away, they got to find another one. Come on, you don't need advanced psychology to at least ask the question. All of that struck me as, in that interview, but not explicit, not put into the words that Tucker Carlson could have and should have. Touched upon, hinted at, but not really. Wow. And by the way, in much of the world, whether the Americans like it or not, but in large parts of the world, Putin's idea is widely believed. I don't know if it's true or not. I'm not commenting on that. But it would be stupid not to understand that in many parts of the world, what Putin says, that this is an attempt by the United States to push NATO closer and closer to Russia and to threaten Russia completely around, you know, from Bulgaria in the south to Finland in the north, and the whole thing, everything that was done after World War II to create that cordon sanitaire, as the French called it, that row of countries that would be a barrier. The barrier is gone. All those countries are now in NATO or are about to become that, or like Ukraine are trying to do that. And the Russians feel endangered. Look, they have been acting and saying this endangers us for a century. They have said it is an existential threat. They have drawn the famous red line. I mean, they've done everything you can ask to make the point, including now going to war, invading Ukraine. Okay, the world, large parts of the world believe that part of this story is the expansion, which means that part of a way out of this war would be, if that's not the intent, then say so. Have a commitment of everybody in the world that Ukraine doesn't join NATO, and that whatever economic relationships it has will not become political and or military. My understanding of the meetings that were held in Istanbul and in Minsk during the period before the war begins and just after it starts, those were the issues on the table. It could have been. And again, I'm not sure that's 100% right. That's what I've been told. I find the work of a Chicago University professor, John Mearsheimer, very helpful. He's a real specialist in this kind of work and has written and commented in great detail, from which I have learned. I don't mind saying so. But if I understand it correctly, these are ways we could end this horrible war. And yet what I get is a refusal. And I cannot, as an American, I cannot help but notice that the war in Afghanistan was clearly also lost years ago, but it took years before any president could dare bring the troops home. But it seems it's very hard for domestic political reasons that the other party will attack you for having lost the war, which is clearly a bipartisan achievement, the lost war. This is a war that never should have begun in the first place, et cetera, et cetera. So all of this seemed to me the core of what was important about the interview. And I think Mr. Putin, whether we like it or not, that's another matter. But he was effective in giving the world a sense that they have a position, that they have their grievances, and that makes a certain sense what they did. So why don't we stop this silly game? Why don't we congratulate Tucker Carlson for having had the courage to go out and have an interview, which is useful for all of us to have seen? And beyond that, my God, it reminds me of my worst teachers who didn't want the students to have any critical perspective for fear it would poison their minds. We all got the critical perspectives. We all knew where to get them. And whatever poisoning of our minds it might have achieved, we would have had it one way or the other. Would have been better if you had talked to us dear teacher, and presented it honestly. We would have learned it better, and we would have had more respect for you. But that's a lesson that either you learn early in life or you don't. And the rest for me, what's most important, to be honest with you, is Tucker Carlson. And if I could indulge you, I would like to talk to you a little bit and to your audience about some important insights into what is going on here in the United States that you can get from the interview by Mr. Carlson of Mr. Putin. It wasn't the point, but it was by far the more important revelation. Okay. What you saw in Mr. Carlson and what you have seen in a number of the interviews he has given since the interview with Putin, because he has been challenged by other media folks like Fareed Zakaria and others who have attacked him, mostly attacked him. Very few have defended him. And I'm not here, I'm not interested neither in the attack nor in the defense. I'm not interested in the attack because basically I think it is mean-spirited. What they're really doing is attacking Mr. Carlson because Mr. Putin comes off as what he is, a political leader. He's strong, he's coherent, and he's effective. He knows how to smile occasionally, etc. I think the reason they're angry is because he doesn't come off as the monster he has been presented as to the American people, which he couldn't because that was a fantasy anyway. He is what he is. He's the product of the Russian system as it has evolved after 1989 and to some degree of the Soviet system before that he grew up in. That he is a product. Not more, not less. That's what he is. He's not a monster. He's that. So it's just, and everything Carlson says about his trip to Moscow has the same quality. It's he recognized that this Putin is the leader of Russia. Impressive in some ways, unimpressive in other ways. A product of his society and his time. But that means he's not the hideous monster that he was led to expect. And if you follow Carlson's interviews later, you'll notice that there are clips. He visits a supermarket in Moscow. And there he has his little cart, and he's going down the aisle, and he grabs a bunch of bananas and puts them in his cart in a plastic wrap to what looks like meat or bread or something. And he's talking about, I can look at me, I'm in a shopping center. He's in a shopping place. He's in a supermarket. It's like a million other supermarkets. It's in no way remarkable as a supermarket. He's amazed by this. Why? Because he imagined a Russia that was monstrous and therefore didn't have the everyday things like a supermarket with bananas and wrapped meat and bread. He talks about, gee, and when I paid for it, it's cheaper than it costs in the United States. You see, again, what did he imagine? It would be much more. He imagined. And then he shows you in other clips that he had taken. His team took pictures. There's a picture of the Soviet, it is the Soviet, but the Russian subway system. For those of you that have never been to Russia and never been to the subway, it's spectacular. It's beyond beautiful, the way it is done. It's crystal clean. It is carefully constructed, beautifully maintained. I mean, it's extraordinary. So most Americans are not aware of that. If you live in New York, as I do, you're used to a subway system that is dirty and broken and really ugly most of the time, right? That's what it is. It's better in other American cities, in fact, but it's no great shakes in most cases. Nothing like the Moscow subway. And he's entranced, as tourists have been for a long time. If you go on any kind of tourist trip in Moscow, they take you into the subway to show it to you because it is a showpiece. So he does all that, and then he says, look at this, look at this. And Fareed Zakaria, to knock him, says something which only shows that Fareed is a hack politically and not a serious thinker. He makes a terrible mistake. He says, poor Mr. Carlson was taken in. In every dictatorship, or some words like that, Zakaria says, there are always pet projects that they put a lot of money in to showcase that they have done something beautiful. Why is Zakaria wrong? Because if you go to the Paris subway, which has never had a Soviet period, you will also see a beautiful, clean subway system, as you will in many other countries. You don't need a Soviet Union. You don't need a dictatorship to have a decent subway. That's Mr. Zakaria wanting to squash Mr. Carlson. Much better to learn, look what's going on here. He expected something monstrous, and he discovered something beautiful. But the mistake here is Tucker Carlson's. What he's telling us, what he's showing us, is that he, and he says this, he was led to believe things about the Soviet Union and about Russia that were crazy, that were fantasies, just like they were led to believe about Mr. Putin. And that Putin is no angel. And Russia is no paradise. It never was. And it wasn't under the Soviet Union either. But the crazy, demonized horror show, the monstrosity painted here, that people growing up in America like Tucker Carlson and like me, that's what we grew up with. So it turns out that when we reach a certain age, for some of us, high school, for some of us, college, for some of us, full career like Tucker, a moment comes, and that's where Tucker is, when he realizes he has been lied to, he has been misled, he has been miseducated, and he's not only upset to learn it, but he's angry. Why was this done to us? Why have we been told this silly story? Why does, and then he gets angry now, why does Fareed Zakaria, who has intelligent things to say sometimes, why is he so upset? Why is he making this mistake? You don't need a dictatorship to have a beautiful, clean subway system. Paris is famous for its clean subway system, and it never had a Soviet dictatorship, not for 1 minute. So what is this? What's going on here? Fareed Zakaria is holding on to the monstrosity. He needs to say that the beautiful subway is a great exception, that these folks, these evil folks, sometimes put resources in to fool us all with the pretty subway. Stop. Fareed, wake up. You've been drinking the Kool-Aid too long. And all Tucker and Tucker Carlson wants is to have some other people join him in saying, wait a minute, let's go look, let's go see, let's have the truth. He's bitter, and he says so. And I think here, I'm going to go out on a limb a little bit, but for those of you that want to understand the United States, you are watching something very important. Yes, Tucker Carlson was once with Trump and with MAGA and with the right wing and with Fox News and with all of it. And he was gung-ho. And when he's asked what's wrong, he likes to give what passes for theory among those people. The theory that all the bad things that are happening are the result of a government. A government is doing bad things. It's never the capitalist system. It's never the economic, social totality. Oh, no, that's great. Oh, that's great. We drink the Kool-Aid. Capitalism, bad government. Get rid of those evil Democrats. Bring in the Republicans who know how bad government can be and will keep it from being bad. This childish mentality, which doesn't ask the logical, obvious question that ought to keep all libertarians up at night. If the government is doing bad things, why is it doing bad things? Who is making it do that? Who runs the government? Is it your typical worker who becomes the president? No, it's your typical employer. Is it your typical employee who becomes the congressperson? No, it's your typical employer. You get the picture? Why the government is and who the government is ought to be your question. By not asking, by making the government the bad guy, all you're doing is protecting all of the forces that make the government do what it is you don't like. And why are you doing that? And whatever your answer is, my response is, I sure hope you're getting paid well for the service you're performing. Tucker Carlson is at a crucial point. And how many million Americans are with him? They're realizing they've been told nonsense about capitalism, socialism, communism, Russia, and many more topics. They now know that what they're told about the Ukraine war is a carefully packaged propaganda story. But it's clear what's going on here. And it's clear to Tucker Carlson now. That's part of why he wanted to go. He wanted to see, can Putin make a case? Or is he just going to stand there and be the hideous monster that we portray him as? You know, the United States, for years before the war in Ukraine, used drones to kill large numbers of people in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and elsewhere. The breastfeeding now for people, for Navalny in Russia, I mean, it is so phony that it takes your breath away. It's inappropriate to jail your opposition. Absolutely. It's horrible to put them in jail, let alone to kill them. No question. But take a step back and ask who is talking to whom about what? The United States invaded four of the poorest countries in the world, Vietnam, Laos, Iraq, Afghanistan. Biggest, most powerful military in the world invading the poorest, and then is outraged when Russia invades Ukraine. What? The ability to live in a world where the United States can just do these things. And I'm not even going to talk now about bombing Yemen, bombing Lebanon, Syria. What? Issuing a statement, we are not interested in escalating the war on the same day that you escalated. Who do you think is fooled by this? So for me, Carlson is realizing there's a lot of fooling going on, and he doesn't want to be the fool. And he's angry that he was made the fool. He's embarrassed by the things he says. He's saying that now. I'm changing, he said. I'm glad I'm changing. I learned things. I've got to change. Look at the supermarket they have in Russia. Look at the subway station they have. Look at this. What I'm learning. My God. And now let me make this prediction. The model for where Mr. Carlson is going is the new left of the 1960s and 70s in the United States. Why? Because there was this same situation. A young new generation grew up. They grew up in the late 1950s and 60s. It was a time when they were told in class that the United States was the land of freedom, equality, democracy, opportunity, and so forth. And as they grew up and went to college and took a job during then the 60s into the 70s, many of them discovered that this wasn't true. That large numbers of people, black ones, brown ones, female ones, poor ones, rural ones, less educated ones, the vast majority didn't have freedom, equality, or opportunity. Wow. They felt betrayed. They felt lied to. The America they had led to believe was their environment wasn't. Slowly, they began to understand when they were shocked to discover that the land of freedom and opportunity was busily mowing down hundreds of thousands of people in the jungles of Vietnam. For what? For what? These poor people were no threat to the United States. 10,000 miles away. What? And they slowly began dimly to understand that the United States was the new global empire, that it was busy replacing the now defunct British Empire, finished in World War II, by itself. And it was organizing and showing the world, we are the new empire. Whether it's Vietnam or Guatemala or Iran, whether it's Arbenz or Mossadegh or anybody else, we're in charge. We will deter. Of course, this involved killing people, wars, devastation. Yeah. And that didn't look good. And a whole. But you know, for those people in the 60s and 70s, the theoretical air was coming from the left. That's because of the Great Depression, the rise of socialism and communism here in the United States that put all that kind of thinking in the air so that young people trying to understand their feeling of betrayal had a left wing explanation. Tucker Carlson never had that. He grew up in an America that hated the left, that was busy moving to the right, that wanted nothing to do with socialism or communism, wanted to believe in robust capitalism, that the government had to be kept away because it was inherently somehow bad. This was the theoretical framework they had to work with. Wasn't much, wasn't very well developed, but that's what they had. So they went with that. As they now undertake what happened to the new left in the 1960s, they began to learn. They began to study. They began to realize they had to rethink the left. They had to rediscover Marxism and socialism and find out what is and isn't useful. And they've been doing that ever since. And a whole new kind of socialism and Marxism are emerging. The work is paying off, taking time, but it's paying off. I suspect the same is underway now on the right. And Mr. Carlson may very well become an important leader if he can stay with his quest, if he can dare, to question the libertarian theory, I'm being polite here, that he has embraced, ask the question why the government is what it is when he's upset about it, why the government lies, why the government goes to war, why. He is smart enough and he's acute enough to get there. And there will be others, whether Tucker Carlson is among them or not, who will. We're going to see the splintering up of the right as it tries to come to terms with what it has to face, which is the horrific gap between the reality of US capitalism at this point and the fantasy story that has been told for half a century now. It's a story that cannot survive. In my period, it couldn't survive the cost of the empire, the Vietnam War, the inequality at home, the fakery in international relations. For them, it can't survive the end of the USM. The decline of the empire is going to be impossible. They can't. There's no place in their universe for it. And it's going to eat at their self-confidence over and over again. I think that's what's going on. And I think what the interview by Mr. Carlson of Mr. Putin, I don't think it changed Mr. Putin all that much, but I think it's a major step on the road to a Mr. Carlson breaking away from what he was, quitting Fox News or pushing until they pushed him out, breaking that connection, that was part of it. Forming his own was part of it. Being now able on his own to make ideological breaks, like talking to Mr. Putin, like the other comments he's made. Remarkable. He was asked in an interview, which caused great concern, about what does he say Mr. Putin killed Mr. Navalny, the opposition person who died in the prison. And he gave the proper answer, which horrifies everybody. He said, I've learned that political leaders kill people. You know what that means? Let me translate. He always believed that the monster evil other, like Putin, killed people. What he's saying is, he knows they all do. And you know what that means? He knows that his own leaders do it too. He's no longer captured by the illusion of the we're good, they're bad, dichotomy, monsterization of the evil other. That kind of politics, childish, widespread in the United States, is in the process of losing one of the intellectuals it needs, it has used, and it has now lost.
One of the points that Putin made during this interview, considering the economy of Russia, he said that more than 50% of Russian trades before this war started in Ukraine was in dollar. Right now, it's below 13%. This is a huge change for 19 months. How do you see this type of behavior coming from these governments who are not accepting the way they were treated by Washington?
Well, I wouldn't go quite so far as you are going. I think this reflects the fact that Russia is now much more reliant on India and China than it used to be, on the BRICS than it used to be. He's right, that was underway before the war in Ukraine. It's accelerated. I think over the long run, there's no question that the dollar will decline in its importance. However, I expect, I could certainly be wrong, I expect that it will take time for that decline to happen. I do not expect it will be in a straight line. You will see it decline sharply. Then it will revive for one reason or another. Countries like India or Saudi Arabia, you know, could make political changes there that reorient how they trade. And you know, the United States has not exhausted the measures it can take to restore the confidence in the dollar. I think the direction of change is unquestioned, but the exact pace and so forth, I don't think we can see that. That's something that you can only measure in years, not in weeks or months, but really only in years, and probably in years, not only those years of a war, when the war kind of shapes it. The United States is in a period of decline, and there is nothing, let me underscore that, there's nothing I see or nothing I can see pointed to by others that suggests to me that that decline is going to be reversed or stopped. I mean, if I saw something, I would say it, but I don't, I just don't see it. I mean, every day it seems to me I see evidence of the other way around. I'll give you an example. Today's headlines are full of, over the last 2 or 3 days, stories about how the leading airline in the world, the company that makes airplanes, Boeing, an American company, is having more and more difficulties. It cannot make airplanes except the kind that crash or have their doors fly off in the middle of the flight. As many of you know, it's having one problem after another. Meanwhile, the Comac Corporation, a Chinese company, just unveiled its new international airplane, the C919, which for the first time is being offered to the whole world. It was available in China. It has now been purchased for the first time by an Indonesian airline, which will use it. But there you have it, the decline of something as crucial to the future of the world as airline traffic, the decline of the old American pioneer and the arrival of the new Chinese. I mean, this story is repeated with electric cars. It's repeated with lithium batteries. It's repeated, but that's the point. It is the direction is unmistakable.